Okay, so first I would like to thank the organizer of the workshop and of the semester for inviting me. Then next I would like to explain my title. So update refers to the fact that I talked about a similar topic at the last workshop. And so I want to mainly report on progress that has been made in the intervening years, mainly by Cutwitz and his students. And thirdly, I want to explain what that affine and linear Lustig varieties, just as in Lomont's talk, affine Springer varieties didn't mean that the varieties were affine, nor does it mean here that the linear Lustig varieties are affine, but rather the affine refers to the root system that underlines this story. So, as to the linear Lustig varieties, let me start by giving the definition in the classical case. So, let's start with the classical situation. So I start with a reductive group G over finite field FQ. And I fix a Borel subgroup. Defined over FQ. And then I extend scalars to the algebraic closure. So let me call this G tilde. Similarly for B. And then we have the following identification, namely the set of double cosets of G with respect to B. This can be identified with the Weil group of G. So in other words, the factor group of the normalizer of a maximal torus by the torus itself. And this defines a relative position map, which I will call the invariant map, as follows. So you take the composition of the following maps. So you have pairs of objects of this coset space. Then this goes into the diagonal quotient of this thing by G tilde. And then obviously this can be identified with the double cosets. And this in turn can be identified with W. So the composition of these maps we call the relative position maps of two flags. And so these are parameterized by elements in the Weil group. And now let me note that since we started with things which were defined over FQ, the Frobenius operates on this coset space. And so I can define now the linear Lustig variety. So we fix a W, element W in the Weil group, and then we have the associated linear Lustig variety which is XW. These are those cosets such that the relative invariant between X and its translate under the Frobenius is given by this fixed element. I mean, these varieties play an important role in analyzing the representation theory of this finite group, but that's not what is relevant for my talk. I mean, here I just want to mention that it's known that this is an irreducible algebraic variety. It's locally closed in the flag variety, and it has dimension the length of W. And you can soup this up a little bit to have generalized delinealistic varieties. For this, you fix a parabolic subgroup, call it P, containing B. And then we look at, instead of the cosets with respect to the Borel subgroup, we look at cosets with respect to the parabolic subgroup. And so you get in exactly the same way. I mean, it should be, of course, defined over FQ. You get a generalized delinealistic variety. And here the W bar, this is now a double coset of the Weyl group, where you divide out on the left and the right by the intersection of the Weyl group with P. So in other words, WP is now equal to the normalizer of this P tilde and sec P tilde divided by P tilde. And the similar fact to the previous one holds in this case also. Okay. And now let me pass to affine delinealistic varieties. So here we fix a local field F. So in other words, F is either a finite extension of QP, or it is the power series ring in one variable over finite field. And I replace now, so this is the replacement of the finite field FQ. I replace the algebraic closure here by the maximal unramified, the completion of the maximal unramified extension. And now I start again with a reductive group over this local field this time. And furthermore, instead of a Borel subgroup, I fix an Iwahori subgroup. Defined over F. If you don't know what this is, it doesn't really matter because I will give examples where you see what it means. And then I have associated to this the group which is, so to speak, the extension of scalar. So then this is here an Iwahori subgroup inside the group of L rational points of the group G. And then the corresponding fact to this first thing about the Weyl group, about the relative, the double cosets, this holds. So in other words, the double cosets of the Iwahori subgroup can be parametrized by the extended affine Weyl group, which in this case is the normalizer of a good maximal torus divided by T tilde L1. K0 tilde. Okay. And so therefore, we get, as before, a relative position map to the extended affine Weyl group. And now, just as before, we can now define the affine delinealistic variety. So for this, we fix an element B in G of L and the W in W tilde, and then the associated affine delinealistic variety. Is the following thing. So I will denote it like this. These are the elements in G of L modulo K0 tilde such that the invariant between X and its image under the transformation B sigma is equal to W. Right. Good remark. Okay, so the remark is the following. If two elements, B and B prime, are sigma conjugate, then it's easy to see that the corresponding affine delinealistic varieties are the same. And now over a finite field, any element, B, is sigma conjugate to the identity by Lang's lemma, and that's why for the finite field there's no need to introduce such an element B. But over this periodic field, I mean over the local field, this is not true. I mean, this is sort of the content of the whole story, that elements, the sigma conjugacy class form a non-trivial set. And so, therefore, we want to incorporate this here into the definition. Okay. So I should say, I call this affine delinealistic variety, although at the moment this is not a variety at all, it's just a set. And this is actually a problem, but over a function field, in the function field case, so if F is a function field, this indeed is an algebraic variety. It's of finite dimension. And locally of finite type. Over the algebraic closure of FQ. And why that is, I mean, and conjecturally this should always hold. So I will always do as if this holds. And you will see in an example that I will give in a minute why this is quite reasonable. And you will also see why this is an algebraic variety. But before I do this, let me also mention the generalized affine delinealistic varieties. So here you replace the Iwahori subgroup by an arbitrary paraholic subgroup. Let's say K containing K0. And then you get again XW bar of B sigma. And now let's indicate this by an index K that this is generalized. So here again, the W bar is a double coset under the corresponding subgroup of the extended affine Y group corresponding to K. So in other words, the intersection of K with this extended affine Y group. Okay, so let me give an example. So for G, we just take G02. And for K, I will take not the Iwahori subgroup, because this is sort of confusing me a little bit, but rather, let's take the maxima paraholic subgroup. So in other words, K tilde will then simply be G of the integers in L. Okay, and furthermore, let's take just B equal to 1. And then notice that in this case, this quotient W tilde by WK, this can be identified with the decreasing pairs of integers. And so for every decreasing pair of integers, we now have an associated generalized affine de Lijn-Lustig variety. And let me start by taking the pair 0, 0. So what is this thing here? Well, in this case, we can identify this double coset space with the lattices lambda inside the vector space of dimension 2. So OL lattices. And now there's a condition that its translate under sigma should be in this relative position with respect to lambda tilde. Well, in this case, it just means that they coincide. So in other words, we have sigma lambda tilde is equal to lambda tilde. But of course, this is simply saying that this lattice actually comes from, by extension, from scalars from F. And so we see that in this case, the affine de Lijn-Lustig variety is simply the building of GL2F. And so this is just a discrete set, which is, of course, an algebraic variety of dimension 0. So every point is there by itself. And now, so we can picture this as follows. So here, inside the building for over L, we have the rational building. Let's fix now a vertex in this building. So let's let lambda be a lattice inside F2. And now let's look at all vertices lambda tilde, which have distance r from this given vertex lambda. Well, at each step in the this is in the building over this maxima and ramified extension. At each step, I, of course, have the choice of one dimension. I mean, because these edges coming out of a given vertex, they form a projective line. So the things which have distance r, they form an algebraic variety. Intuitively, they form an algebraic variety of dimension r. Now, what happens to such a lattice lambda tilde when I apply sigma? Well, it has to be a path which immediately leaves the rational building, because otherwise this thing here would be rational. So in other words, the distance between lambda tilde and sigma of lambda tilde is equal to 2r. So if this distance is r, then this is here the geodesic from lambda tilde to sigma of lambda tilde, and so therefore this distance has to be r, 2r. And so we see that if we take now a general x mu sigma, we see that this is an algebraic variety which is empty if mu 1 minus mu 2 is odd, because this relative position cannot occur, and it has dimension 1 half mu 1 minus mu 2 if it is even. And now in the function field case, the lattices which are squeezed between lambda, I mean the lattices which have distance r from this given lambda, they will be squeezed between lambda and pi inverse, pi minus r times lambda, and they have to satisfy certain conditions to have distance r. But these, the point is, in the function field case, this quotient pi minus r lambda divided by lambda, this is a vector space over the ground field FQ. And the conditions that describe that this has distance r, these are algebraic conditions. And this is why in the function field case, this is in fact an algebraic variety. Okay. And so, generally, one can now ask the following questions or problems. First, when is X W bar B sigma K non-empty? Note that over finite field, this can never occur because these varieties are always non-empty because they have dimension length of W. But here, as we saw, this can occur. And secondly, I mean, are these varieties equidimensional and is there a formula? For their dimension. Okay, so these are the two problems that I want to address in my talk. Seems that these questions are not so easy in general, and the case in which most, in which one knows most, is the case where we take not the Ivahori case. This is in some sense the hardest, but rather the other extreme. This is why also why I gave this example, namely the case where the parahoric subgroup is what is called a hyperspecial parahoric subgroup. Okay, so let me start by saying something about this case. So I now take G to be an unramified group scheme over F. So unramified means simply that it can be extended over the integers as a reductive group over the integers of F. So for instance, split, so it extends over spec OF, and we take for K the hyperspecial maximal parahoric. So that means that the K tilde is simply the integral points of this group scheme. Okay, furthermore, we fix a Borel subgroup. Over F, and then we put A, this is the vector space of invariant co-characters of T. And furthermore, I have inside this the positive ones, in other words, just the intersection with the positive Y chamber defined by B. Okay, and now I have to recall two maps. So I mean, first of all, obviously a big, I mean, an important role is played by these elements B up to sigma conjugacy. So I denote, this is the standard notation introduced by Kotwitz. This is the set of sigma conjugacy classes. Of GL, and there's a fairly complete classification of the set due to Kotwitz, and this classification uses two ingredients which I will need. So, first of all, there's the Newton map. Which goes from B of G into A plus. So in the case of GLN, this just means that associated to B, we take the sequence of slopes in decreasing order. This is one ingredient, and the other one is the Kutowitz map. Denoted by kappa, which goes into pi 1 of g co-invariant under gamma. So in the case that g is split, you can actually forget about the co-invariance, and then pi 1 of g is simply the factor group of the co-character group of t by the co-character group of the semi-simple covering of t, of g. Okay, and then finally, we of the simply connected covering. So you divide out x lower star of t by the, simply connected. Okay, and then finally, I have this corresponding fact to this one here, namely w k tilde, the double cosets, under this case here are simply can be identified with the dominant co-characters in T. And so to every element B and G of L and mu dominant co-character, I associate the corresponding generalized affine de Lisle-Lustig variety, which I will just denote by x mu of B sigma, or by x mu upper G of B sigma. In other words, I'm leaving out the k in the notation, because it's self-understood that k is simply the group of integral points of this group scheme. Okay, so now we have defined the object in this hyperspecial case, and so there are two questions here. First of all, when is this here non-empty? Okay, and so let me mention in this respect one fact, proposition. Namely, if the affine de Lisle-Lustig variety corresponding to me, B and mu is non-empty, then the sigma conjugacy class of B lies inside a finite subset of B of G, which is defined by mu. Namely, it is a set defined by the by Mazur's inequality. So, I mean, let me say what this is. If G is split, then B of G mu is the set of sigma conjugacy classes which have the following property. First of all, the image of B under the Newton map is smaller or equal to mu in the usual partial order on the set A plus. And the second thing is that if I look at the image of the of B under the Kutowitz map, then this should be simply the image of mu. I mean, it should be simply the residue class of mu under the obvious map into this quotient group pi 1. So these are the two conditions. For GLN, this here means that the So this here means that the Newton polygon, I mean in my normalization, let's say, lies below the Hodge polygon corresponding to mu, and this condition here means that they both have the same endpoint. Okay, so we have this proposition. This proposition is due to Richards and myself, but recently there has been a much better proof of this due to Cottwitz, which, so I want to mention this to give pleasure to at least one member in this audience, namely the main ingredients of this new proof is a positivity lemma, which is due to Harishchandra and Arthur. And comes up in the calculation of weighted orbital integrals. Okay. And so the obvious conjecture is that the converse holds. So in other words, whenever I take a mu and a b such that the sigma conjugacy class lies in this finite subset of B of G, then the corresponding affine delinealistic variety should be non-empty. And so let me state the following theorem in this direction. So the converse holds. If either first, G is a split classical group, okay, so this is due in the case of GLN and the symplectic group. To Cottwitz and myself, and this has recently been proved for the orthogonal groups by a student of Cottwitz, Lee. Okay, so this is one statement, and the second statement by a completely different method. This was proved if G is arbitrary, but mu is minuscule. So this is a result of Van Damberger. And in general, I should say, the method that this team here has been pursuing is that one can in fact reduce this conjecture to a purely combinatorial question on root systems. And so, I mean, in principle, one can just try to check this case by case, although it doesn't seem to be so easy. But I mean, I should say that I'm not an expert on this, so it's hard for me to judge how difficult it is to check this. Okay, so this is, I think, more or less what we know about the question of when these things are non-empty. Now, how about dimension? So let me state the conjecture. This conjecture is, by the way, inspired by a very beautiful formula of Chai in a context which is related. So let's assume to simplify G split. So I fix a dominant co-character mu, and I let B be an element in G of L whose sigma conjugacy class, well, first of all, of course, it should lie in the subset B of G mu, because otherwise it would be empty. But secondly, I in fact want to assume that this is the unique minima element in the subset, namely it's basic. This is the unique minima element. Okay, and then the conjecture is that this is equidimensional of dimension equal to the following expression, 2 rho mu plus sum I equals 1 to L. And now you take the integral part of minus omega I mu, where omega 1 up to omega L are the dominant coweights. Of the adjoint group. So this is the formula. Let me consider two special cases of this formula. Case where B is equal to 1, so in other words where mu is equal to 0. You mean how many there are? Smooth? Good question. Okay, I don't know. Good question. So it's good to give a talk. Okay, I have to think about it. Okay. So in this case, mu equals to 0. No, wait a minute. Do I mean mu equals to 0? No, I don't mean mu equals to 0. I mean b equal to 1. Wait a minute, this means mu equal to 0. Okay, I don't mean mu equal to 0. I mean the special case where this thing is equal to 0. So in other words, it's a co-character in the simply connected group. In this case, b is equal to 1, and the dimension comes out then to be simply rho comma mu. It seems, I just was on the phone on Sunday, it seems that Cutwitz and Ruhmann can now prove this. I mean, so, of course he told me not to mention this, but I know. That's why I'm adding this. Okay. Another special case which is interesting is the case where you take GLN and where the core character is 1, 0, 0, 0. In this case, the formula would predict the following. So we have 2 rho and mu, which is n minus 1 in this case simply, and then we have this integral part of these inner products where it turns out that this is always equal to minus 1. And so therefore, this is n minus 1 minus n minus 1, so it's 0. This is also true. This is a very extreme case. So let me mention the following proposition. No, rho, rho. Yeah, the difference. In this case, these inner products are just integers, and so therefore I'm just subtracting again the sum over omega I, and we just discussed this is equal to rho. So, okay. So, let me mention the following proposition. So, I assume for safety that G is equal to GLN, and I'm asking myself, when does it happen that the dimension, I'm assuming that I'm in the same situation as in the conjecture. So I take a dominant mu, I take a B, which is basic in this corresponding finite set, B of G mu, and I'm asking myself, when does it happen that this dimension is equal to zero? And the point is, this is true if and only if mu is one of the following, where there's a trivial case where it's just central. So I take just the vector which is 1 in all n places and I take a multiple of it. And then there's this case that I just discussed, namely 1, 0, 0 plus r times I. So r is just some arbitrary integer. And the center doesn't play a role in this question. And then finally there's the case where it's everywhere 1 except for 0 at the last place, and then no other case. So this is pretty striking. These cases are the ones which are considered by Drienfeld in his calculation of orbital integrals, and I firmly believe that for all other groups this never occurs except if mu is central. So in other words, the dimension is always positive, it's always positive if mu is non-central, except in these two cases here. And this is related, as Lomon pointed out to me, to the fact that in Drienfeld's work, he actually calculates, when he proves the fundamental lemma that he needs, he does this by calculating explicitly both sides of the identity. And it's well known that this is essentially impossible in all other cases. And I think the reason lies here in this fact. It's not yet a fact. This is sort of a guess. That for all other split adjoint groups, whenever this dimension is equal to zero, then, this can never happen unless mu is central. Okay. So maybe I mention one other thing which puts this maybe a little bit in perspective. So here I had always assumed that B was basic, in other words, is a unique minima element, but there's also a unique maxima element. This is what is called the mu ordinary element. And in this case, it's easy to see. So if I take a mu, maybe I can only do this, I actually only check this where cases where G is equal to GLN or the symplectic group. Maybe for some other small examples. Anyways, if mu is a dominant co-character and B is in G of L such that, well, of course it has to be in here, otherwise it's it is empty, and this, I'm now assuming that this is the new ordinary element. So in other words, this is the unique maxima element. And in this case, this set here, not only is it discrete, but actually it is acted on transitively by the automorphism group of the corresponding isocrystal. So in other words, I take J B sigma, maybe the adjoint group of F. So in particular, and this is a discrete group, it is of dimension zero. I mean, this should hold in general and shouldn't be too hard to prove this. The proof is pretty simple in these cases. I just checked this, so to speak, by hand, but in general, I think it should be true. The interesting question is what happens in between. In other words, when you have a B, which lies in the subset, but it lies in between the minima element and the maxima element, I mean, there I just haven't done enough calculations to have a conjecture. I mean, I just don't know. Okay. So let me conclude this hyper-special case by giving a descent lemma in the sense of Harishchandra for these affine delinealistic sets. So we start now with a parabolic subgroup containing B. And we write, as usual, the Levy component, I mean P is equal to M times N, where M is the unique Levy component containing the maxima torus T. And then associated to this, I have the usual thing, namely, I take the vector space, which is given by the split center of M. Then inside it, I have the positive things. So these are the ones where the roots, which are positive on the unipotent radical N, take positive values. So these are the X and A, P, such that alpha x is greater than 0 for all alpha of a p on n. And then finally, I denote by pm gamma plus the inverse image of this cone A plus under the map. So I mean inside pi 1 m gamma under the map pi 1 of m gamma goes to its corresponding real vector space. So in other words, I'm first killing torsion, but then this thing here can be identified with AP. And so I just take the inverse image of the positive guys in there. And then the descent lemma is the following theorem. Just due to Cutwitz. So I let mu be a dominant coweight. I take an element B, which actually lies in M and is basic there. And furthermore, it should be really attached to M. So this means that the image under the Cutwitz map for M of B lies in this positive part of pi 1 of M. And then if mu has image in pi 1 of M sub gamma equal to this element, equal to kappa M of B, then the natural inclusion of the affine delinealistic variety for M inside the affine delinealistic variety for G is a bijection. Well, in the case of GLN, what this means is the following. So I start with a B. Basic means, I want to choose a Levy a subgroup in which it is basic. Well, I just look at the slope sequence of B, and this partitions our integers between 1 and n into intervals. Corresponding to these intervals, I have a standard Levy subgroup. And then this here will be automatically satisfied. And now the second condition, namely that nu has image equal to kappa m of b, this means that the Hodge polygon goes through all breakpoints of the Newton polygon. And then it's well known that the corresponding crystal breaks up into direct sum of crystals, and this is a theorem of Katz. So this is a generalization of Katz's theorem. But the proof is completely different, and again, it uses this positivity lemma of Harishchandra and Arthur. Okay, so in the remaining 10 minutes, maybe 7 minutes, I want to say something about general paraholics. And there the situation is much more difficult. And their situation is much more difficult. There seems to be a difference between the case where mu is minuscule and the general case. But so let me mention one theorem, which is very recent, due to Vantin Berger. So he assumes G is unramified. K is an arbitrary parahoric subgroup. Over F. And again, we assume we fix a dominant coweight. And element B in G of L such that the corresponding class lies in this finite subset. In this case, by the way, it is not even known whether this is a necessary condition. This is already the first thing that's not so pleasant. But I mean, I think it's reasonable to assume that this is always a necessary condition. So he assumes this, and then the statement is, well, you see, I didn't fix here a Weyl group element as I should have. I mean, an element in the affine Weyl group. And in fact, he cannot prove anything about the individual affine, the linealistic varieties, but he proves that if you put several of them together, and this is non-empty. And here, this set here is the following. No, mu is arbitrary. Mu is arbitrary. Maybe it's a union of these affine linealistic varieties where W ranges over what is called the admissible set for mu. Namely, so this is a subset that has been investigated by Haynes and Go in the affine Weyl group, and so it's just defined in the following way. So let's say if K is an Iwahori subgroup, then this admissible set are those elements in the extended affine Weyl group which are smaller in the Brüher order, so the translation of corresponding to a conjugate of mu. So in other words, even though Vantin Berger cannot say anything about the individual affine linealistic varieties, he at least can assure that inside this finite subset there is a W such that the corresponding affine linealistic variety is non-empty. In fact, this is something that I learned here at this conference. He can replace the Brüher order, which appears here, by a different order, which is called the weak Brüher order, although it is stronger than the Brüher order. So there's a guy here in algebraic combinatorics who explained to me that weak refers to the fact that there are fewer relations. And it's defined in the following way. So recall that the Brüher order is defined in the following way. The bigger element can be written as a smaller element times a product of reflections such that the length goes up by one at each step. The weak Brüher order is defined by saying that you insist on these reflections to be simple reflections. Okay, so this is the one general theorem that I know. There's another one which is in this paper by Cottwitz and myself, which refers to the case where G is derived from GLN, or the symplectic group by restriction of scalars, and where the mu is minuscule. In this case, we can prove the similar thing to this one here, but also nothing for the individual affine linealistic varieties. And these seem to be very difficult, and so I want to conclude my talk by giving an example of this, which is due to a student of Cottwitz, namely Ruhmann, and which maybe gives you an idea of how complicated this thing is. So, I don't know, do we have to switch off the light? Maybe not. Okay, so this is here the affine wire group for SL3. I mean, actually, this thing didn't come out right. I mean, you should think of, let's see, I don't want to make a mistake here. Right? I mean, this, and these things didn't come out right here. And so on. You're supposed to complete these triangles in this way. And so what he is depicted here is the following. So first of all, this is an enumeration of all the elements in the affine wire group for SL3. Then this is here the base alcove, so this corresponds to the unit element. And then these numbers that are inside one of these triangles, this is the dimension of the corresponding affine delinealistic variety. And if there is nothing, so for instance, where's this here? No. Here. I mean, here, for instance, there's no number in this. This means that the dimension is equal to, no, that the thing is empty. Okay. And now, what are these areas? These areas, Ruhmann calls, this is here, Ruhmann, he calls the Franken Weyl chambers. This means that you have the vector Weyl chamber here, but you want to go away from the walls a little bit. Inside these areas here, inside these shrunken Weyl chambers, he has discovered a regularity, and so he has a formula. So this area can be defined in general, and he has a formula for the dimension of the corresponding affine delinealistic variety. I mean, as soon as one gets sort of close to the walls, this formula doesn't seem to work, and he hasn't been able to make sense out of this. So he also did the case of the symplectic group. It's pretty impressive, I mean, I think, goes up to dimension 17 over here. I mean, generally speaking, obviously it goes up as you go out, but I mean, it's not so clear how to see the pattern, but he was able to see the pattern and gave a conjecture formula. So he has a formula for this case, I mean, which is checked in these two cases. And he says that there are actually several ways of extrapolating this formula to higher rank cases. And so I think it's now time for the computer to take over to check how it works for GF4, SF4, or SP6. And I think he will be able to do this. And then at least we have a formula, conjectural formula, for the dimension of these things. But one thing I think is clear, namely that the hyperspecial case gives the false impression that one has an easy answer to these questions. I think these questions are not so easy. Okay. Thank